This podcast is supported by the Shalom Hartman Institute. For decades, the Shalom Hartman Institute has been the preeminent destination for Jewish ideas and learning. The weekly Identity Crisis podcast with host Yehuda Kurtzer creates better conversations around issues facing contemporary Jewish life. For Heaven's Sake, the award-winning number one Judaism podcast with Daniil Hartman and Yossi Klein Halevi features thoughtful discussions on political and social trends in Israel and Israel-diaspora relations. Discover these chart-topping podcasts at shalomhartman.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Book Review podcast has been around for almost 14 years, and we would love to hear your feedback. Let us know what you think by joining our panel at nytimes.com/thebookreview. Thanks so much. How much should we worry about the state of contemporary Judaism? My colleague Gal Beckerman will join us to talk about his review of five new books that look at the place of Jews in America today. How do you reconcile with a childhood of trauma? Kiesi Lehman will be here to talk about his new memoir, Heavy. Alexander Alter will give us an update from the publishing world. Plus, we'll talk about what we and the wider world are reading. This is the Book Review Podcast from the New York Times. I'm Pamela Paul. Joining us now, my colleague, Gal Beckerman, who is an editor at The Book Review and the author of the book, When They Come For Us, We'll Be Gone, The Epic Struggle to Save Soviet Jewry. Gal, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So Gal is not here to talk about his book, although he may in future, but to talk about five books about contemporary Judaism, which he reviews in a long essay on the cover of The Book Review this week. I'm going to go quickly through the authors and titles of the books, and then we will go back and talk about them a bit individually and all together. So the books are Tal Kindman's God is in the Crowd, 21st Century Judaism, The New American Judaism, How Jews Practice Their Religion Today by Jack Wertheimer, Amos Oz's Dear Zealots, Letters from a Divided Land, Steve Wiseman's The Chosen Wars, How Judaism Became an American Religion, and finally, The Jewish-American Paradox, Embracing Choice in a Changing World by Robert Mnuchin. All right. That's a lot of reading.
It's a lot of reading, a lot of books about Jews, yes.
Yes. And this is something that we conceived of over the summer. And looking at these books together, you were kind of looking ahead at the fall and noted that all of these books were coming out over the course of the next few months.
That's right.
And how are they thematically similar?
Well, they're all kind of from various angles kind of approaching this question of a crisis in American Jewry, the question of where, as a community, as an identity, American Jews are going. But they are really all approaching it from different angles. So, for example, the Chosen Wars is the book by Steven Weissman is a history book, mm-hmm. and it looks at the 19th century and really the moment at which American Judaism became this unique thing at the hands of reformers who decided to make it anew, basically for an American society.
All right. I want to actually pause there and talk more about that, because how did Judaism differ in the United States? First of all, when did Jews begin to immigrate in significant numbers, and how long were they here before that influx?
Well, Jews had been here from the 17th century, but mm-hmm. in very small numbers. There was a small Sephardic population, Jews who came from originally from Spain and then found their way here. But the larger numbers began to happen in the 19th century. For most of the 19th century, there was a community that was an identified community, but they really numbered in the thousands. So by mm-hmm. 1870, you had, I think, 250,000 Jews. And that built up really through the middle of the 19th century when German Jews started to come. Mm-hmm. But the big numbers was from 1870 to about 1920. It went from 250,000 to 4 million. And that's the Eastern European influx that we mostly know about when we think about American Jews and their heritage. But it was that period before the Eastern European Jews came, really in the 19th century, where the kind of the structure, the theology, the rituals of Reform Judaism, which is still the dominant form of American Judaism, was set in place.
So they were coming, they were both Ashkenazi Jews and Sephardic Jews, but predominantly Ashkenazi
Jews Ashkenazi Jews. The big numbers, the German Jews first, mid-19th century, and then the Eastern European Jews at the end and into the 20th century, Ashkenazi Jews.
Right. Yeah. But there remain certain divisions even within the Jewish community had existed between German Jews and the—
And the Eastern European Jews, for sure. Because the German Jews who arrived really were very much set on reform, on making an American kind of Western-style religion. They borrowed a lot of kind of, you know, what even at the time was acknowledged were kind of Christian trappings. You know, so suddenly you had an organ, you had choirs, you had men and women sitting together. You had all of these things that kind of tried to adapt the religion to the environment of America. And I think also, and I say this in the essay, trying to make the Jews there themselves feel less alien, not just to their neighbors, but to themselves. You know, mm-hmm. they had kind of this split identity where they were starting to really assimilate, really become successful in America, especially that German Jewish cohort, you know, became extremely successful businessmen, you know, Levi Strauss. You know, there's a whole world, including the people who ended up, you know, owning this newspaper.
Right.
They came from that world and they really wanted to become American. And so they turned the religion into one that would be kind of not just acceptable to others or kind of accessible to others, but that would make them feel less split in their identity.
Right. So where they were coming from, were they in both Germany and in Eastern Europe predominantly reform, conservative, Orthodox, modern Orthodox? Did that even exist as we know it today?
Well, those denominations really took shape in the 19th century. And, mm-hmm. and so they were coming from environments where, I mean, there was just Orthodox, there were traditional Jews. And in really once, you know, about 20, 30 years after Jews kind of became emancipated at the end of the 18th century in places like Germany, thinkers like Moses Mendelssohn began there was something called the Jewish Enlightenment. That's where the reform really started.
This move towards reform, was it predominantly in America then, or?
It started in Germany, mm-hmm. but it really took off in America for reasons that we can all imagine. You know, America was just more of a tabula rasa. And communities of Jews were scattered here in a way that, you know, that they weren't in Germany. The biggest community of Jews in America in, like, the 1840s was in Charleston, South Carolina. Hmm. There were just 700, but they became actually a real kind of front line for reform.
I have to ask about the title, because the subtitle of Stephen Wiseman's book does sound like a history, mm-hmm. how Judaism became an American religion. But the title, The Chosen Wars, indicates something else. I mean, what are the wars that he is referring to there?
He's talking about the wars between the reformers and the traditionalists mm-hmm. in that period. And that was a war that was really won by the reformers. I mean, once the Eastern European Jews came, once that big influx that I mentioned, you know, at the end of the 19th century, those were people coming with very traditional ideas about Judaism. So there was still a long period of integration for them. But once they really kind of fully became American, say their children or their children's children, they became Reform Jews too. So Reform really won that war in America.
And this is a history, as you said, but is there a point of view to it? Is there an argument that Wiseman is trying to make about the way in which Judaism developed in this country?
Yeah, I mean, he's trying to say that American Jews really came here and in that attempt to really make an American religion, they reshaped Judaism. They made it not a religion that was about a kind of a separate chosen people sitting and waiting for the Messiah to come, but a people that was going to be active in this world, and particularly American society. They threw out the prayers calling, waiting for the Messiah. They threw out the prayer, hoping to return to Palestine, to Zion. And they said, this is our home. And our role here is going to be almost as not waiting for the Messiah, but a messianic people mm-hmm. who are like trying to, you know, be these kind of ethical high priests and engage in social justice, basically. It was like a social gospel. And that really gave them a way to like fit into American society. And what's remarkable is that, you know, 130 years later from when this really, you know, kind of took form, crystallized in America, that's still a lot of how American Jews kind of see their Judaism or their Jewish identity, a predominant number, like really see social justice and social justice activism as being a kind of a Jewish activity.
All right. Well, that brings us right up to today. So I want to talk about two of the other books that seem to be focused more on contemporary American Judaism. And let's start with the one by Robert Mnookin, who is a law professor at Harvard. And his book is called The Jewish American Paradox, Embracing Choice in a Changing World. What does that subtitle mean?
So Nukin is a man who, you know, I think he's in his 60s and he didn't have much of a Jewish identity growing up, he says in the book. But later in life, he began to kind of worry about his grandchildren, really, and whether or not they would feel connected in any way, and began to kind of examine the question of why American Jews seem to be dwindling. And the answer that he came up with is that Jews in general think of Jewish identity as one that is given by descent, and matrilineal descent in particular. If you're in Judaism, if your mother is Jewish, then you're automatically Jewish. You cannot believe in God. You can never call yourself a Jew, but you're considered Jewish.
And is that the same in all three of those sort of major traditions, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox?
So Reform has, in the last, 30 years, I don't remember the exact date. I think it was sometime in the 80s, kind of decided to take on patrilineal descent as a legitimate form of Jewish identity.
So either or.
Either or, yeah. Mm-hmm. Even conservative Jews, which is just, slightly to the left of Reform, in terms of practice and abiding by tradition, it's taken them a really long time. I mean, they just in the last month, really, as I was writing this piece, it was a news story that conservative Jewish kind of establishment finally allowed rabbis to attend intermarriage ceremonies, not even officiate, but just be there.
Right, right.
It had not been allowed to even be a presence.
And yet I'm curious because there has been, as you said, this move towards reform. And this is an anecdotal perception, and correct me if it's wrong, but one of the things that I've heard among people of our generation, let's not age us too much, but let's say the parents' generation, many of them were still part of that move towards assimilation,
right,
that move towards embracing Hanukkah, for example, as a sort of full celebratory equivalent or alternative to Christmas, occasionally even celebrating Christmas too in a secular way, to then a generation that grew up in that way, but is now seeing Reform Judaism kind of become more conservative, that synagogues are sort of seem to be pulling back on some of that, what they perceive as maybe an overstep towards assimilation. Is that true?
I mean, I think it's complicated. I think it depends on which congregation, which Reform rabbi. There definitely is kind of a melding together in some ways of conservative Judaism, which was, again, like this kind of reaction to Reform. They wanted to bring in some more of the tradition, some more of observance of Jewish law. So like a melding of that and Reform, I think, has happened. So to that extent, yes, Reform has become a little bit less reformy. There have been trends in the last 30 years, let's say, that really indicate that American Jews, if they want to kind of maintain a unique identity, a unique sense of themselves as a community with its own kind of particular characteristics, it's becoming harder and harder to do. I mean, I mentioned here the rate of intermarriage of Jews marrying non-Jews. It's now, for the non-Orthodox, it's at 72%. And there's been plenty of studies that show that if you grow up in a household without two Jewish parents, then, somehow you're, less Jewishly identified. Mm-hmm. And then, you can just do the math going forward. It means a very kind of dwindling Jewish population. Now, one of the things that Nukin says in his book is that we're being too doctrinaire, in terms of how we think of who is a Jew.
Right.
And he wants to, he has this line where he says he wants the chosen people to become the choosing people, so that Jews themselves, if you decide you want to be a Jew, whether you have one parent who's Jewish, whether it's your father or your mother, whether you're married to somebody who's Jewish and you just feel very involved in the raising of Jewish children, you get to be a Jew.
So it's this kind of big tent idea.
Exactly.
Rather than sort of go back to the core of the theology and the identity and be sort of even stricter about
exactly.
that, but the opposite.
Mm-hmm. And there's even some, there's been interesting, in 2013, there was Pew did this, the biggest study that it's, I think Pew has ever done, but that has been done in a long time about American Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the kind of interesting aspects that was pulled out of the study was that if you talk to people with only one Jewish parent, millennials of that, who are in that category are much more likely to identify as Jewish than people over 65
mm-hmm.
in that category, which tells us that, even the last 20, 30 years of trying to open up like Reform, and saying patrilineal lineage is fine, that actually has an impact on how if you let people feel accepted, they actually want to be Jewishly engaged.
So since we're talking about polls and surveys and numbers, I have to ask this question because it, I think, gets at one of the biggest misperceptions about Jews in this country. what percentage of this country is Jewish or self-identifies as Jewish?
So right now it's about 2%, but it's interesting to think about that number. And this goes back to that Pew poll, because they asked specifically people who are Jews, whether they're Jewish by religion, whether they think of themselves as Jewish.
Right. As opposed to, say, culturally or ethnically Jewish,
exactly,
which is another question.
Exactly. Which is another question. People can say, you know, I have a Jewish parent, but I'm not Jewish. I'm not Jewish by religion. And that number is growing. They call them, in the Pew study, they call them the nuns, having no, not nuns as in, you know,
N-U-N.
Catholic nuns, but N-O-N-E. And that number is interesting because among millennials, it's 32%.
Is there something about the way in which Judaism has been practiced in the last, say, century or the last couple of generations in America that has led to that increasing number?
Well, here's where my argument comes in, mm-hmm, and kind of where these books kind of prompted me to think deeply about that question precisely. It seems to me that, you know, this reform that happened in the 19th century was this very big moment. You know, it was pretty radical. You know, they threw out the theology, they threw out the rituals, and they really made it their own. But what happened in the 20th century is there wasn't really like a prompting to do that kind of revitalization again. There were other ways to kind of anchor identity, notably the Holocaust, which, mm-hmm, became for American Jews created a feeling of obligation to the dead that, you know, you can't give up this identity. You know, mm-hmm, look at all these people who were murdered just for having it. That was a very big motivator for two or three generations, up until my own, I'd say. And then Israel, which was this great source of kind of dignity and pride for American Jews, you know, I'd say certainly up until 1967, but even after that, you know, for certain generations.
Well, it's interesting when you get to this idea of contemporary Judaism being associated with social activism.
Right.
And we talk about our current moment in, right, relationship to Israel. That has shifted again.
Yeah, it has. Yeah. What I was going to say was that those two anchors, the Holocaust and Israel, have kind of become much looser. The Holocaust, you know, people, of course, still remember the Holocaust, but the generation of survivors is dying out. And Israel, as you said, has become a much thornier issue. And you really have, you know, this sense that America kind of represents the kind of universalist Jew who is interested in the wider society that they're involved in, their concerns. If you talk to American Jews, you know, they might mention Israel, but they'll also mention immigration, they'll mention reproductive rights, they'll mention all these other things that matter to them about American society. Versus if you go to Israel, it's a much kind of more particularist side of things. And you have the society is based around the idea that this is a place to protect the future lives of Jews, you know? So it's more kind of tribal in that sense.
All right, I want to turn to Israel in, yeah, a second, but let's talk first about the other book that's really looking at how Jews practice their religion today. That's the subtitle of Jack Wertheimer's book, which is called The New American Judaism. What is he doing in this book?
So he's a sociologist, and that book was interesting because he's really delving into, you know, he's not doing a kind of quantitative study, but he was kind of qualitatively trying to understand something about how the actual practice of the religion has changed. And for me, the more interesting parts were the kind of non-Orthodox Jews, which make up 90% of American Jewry. And he thinks that we've kind of turned into what he calls a cafeteria religion, which is that, you know, these old denominational lines of reform and conservative and even Orthodox to some extent are kind of like falling apart. And people are just picking and choosing the aspects of the tradition that matter to them. And in some cases, there's kind of funny combinations that are happening. So people who, you know, would never think to eat kosher, you, mm-hmm, know, who eat whatever they want, would, when a relative dies, a mother or a father dies, they want to strictly obey the laws of mourning. Or a ritual practice like the mikveh, which is like the ritual bath, which really was only, you know, Orthodox Jewish women did, now is something that has kind of been turned into kind of a spiritual practice by Jews who are much, much less observant.
So it's this kind of buffet style, take what you will and leave the rest on,
exactly,
the tray.
Exactly. It's sort of a buffet style, which I find personally to be actually sort of hopeful, because to me it's indicative of kind of a return to that 19th century moment of saying like, okay, we are right now, you know, Americans in this country, modern human beings, and we want this religion, we want this tradition, but we need to make it meaningful for ourselves. And what do we do to make it meaningful for ourselves? And maybe it means kind of opening the whole thing up and saying, which of these rituals actually matters to us and gives us kind of an exalted sense of being part of something.
Let's turn to the last two books. These I'm grouping together because the author in the case of Amos Oz is Israeli, mm-hmm. and Tal Kindman is American-born, but also I think either lives in Israel or has lived in Israel and spent a lot of time there. So let's talk first about Tal Kindman's God is in the Crowd, 21st Century Judaism. Is he talking about Judaism on a global scale, or is he talking about it in America, in Israel?
His big point is that this is a guy who grew up in a very assimilated American Jewish household, and then at some point in towards the end of high school had kind of a feeling of kind of a revelation that he had to move to Israel, and move to Israel and not just move there, but became a fighter pilot, which is almost the most intense sort of military training that you can do. But then kind of became disenchanted with both societies and now kind of jumps between them. And His feeling was that those two poles that I described, you know, one society that's kind of beholden to very kind of universalist values and one that's beholden to very kind of particularist values, is problematic for all Jews, because he looks at this kind of earlier period of diaspora when Jews were scattered all over the world before there was kind of the bipolar world that we have now. And in kind of community by community, Jews had to balance like this universal versus particular instinct. Like, mm-hmm. how tribal were they going to be? How much were they going to engage with the outside world? What was going to be the kind of right balance that they were going to find between those two things that were going to allow them both to survive and also to thrive and continue? And he thinks that's kind of been lost, mm-hmm. that kind of mishmash of conversation and debate and figuring things out, which he thinks is like a beautiful aspect of Jewish tradition kind of before things kind of calcified into the way they are now. So a lot of his kind of ideas about how to kind of break through that seem sort of far-fetched to me reading it, mm-hmm. but it's definitely inspired in the sense that he's trying to like return. He thinks that to save both Israel and America from kind of self-destructing, and he puts it in those stark terms, they need to really engage with each other and bring a little bit of what each has managed to kind of capture.
All right. Finally, let's talk about Amos Oz, Dear Zealots, Letters from a Divided Land, which is translated by Jessica Cohen. Right. Most people think of Oz as a novelist, but of course he writes opinion pieces. He does a lot of other things. What is he doing in this book?
So Oz is coming from an Israeli perspective, but he's looking at Judaism as a tradition, again, like Kenan, that he thinks is quite dynamic, that has this history of interpretation and counter-interpretation and reinterpretation. The thing that the phrase that I love that I got out of reading this book the most is the notion that Jews are a people without a pope. Mm-hmm. There's no dogma. The whole tradition is so laden with this kind of, he calls it an anarchist spirit of like constantly burning it down and starting up
and again. Questioning,
right. So what he sees happening in Israel in his particular context is this kind of beautiful Hebrew secular culture. You know, mm-hmm. he says, if you want to look at where the religion kind of continued, look at the Israeli novelists, look at what they're doing, you know, not at the Orthodox establishment, which is setting down a lot of laws in Israel in terms of, you know, who can be a Jew and who can't be a Jew in a quite prohibitive way. But what I took from his book is somebody who really like rejoices in the potential of change within a religion that, as I say in this piece, kind of needs to really think about, you know, how it moves forward.
I wanted to start off by talking about these books because you had conceived of this idea around the books that were coming out, which really look at very broad issues in contemporary Judaism. And you wrote this essay and you handed it in, and then something terrible happened in this country, the mass murder in Pittsburgh. How did that change the way you approached this?
In some ways, it made it feel more urgent to mm-hmm. me. What I felt after Pittsburgh was this incredible coming together of American Jews and a lot of warmth and a lot of a sense of resilience, and that this was a community that really kind of wanted to come together, wanted to share its values, its sense of value of itself that it has. But it also felt a little bit like an illusion. It mm-hmm. felt like the sense of being victims actually gave Jews this kind of brief, fleeting moment of something that they really are losing.
Identity or unity?
Identity and a sense of shared identity. Mm-hmm. And it made me feel like, yes, you know, we need to talk now about what does that identity look like? Mm-hmm. And it can't be the cultural ethnic identity. It certainly can't be victimhood. You know, we don't want shootings to have to be the thing that makes Jews feel kind of solid in their identity. And so to me, the kind of source that was sitting out there for that identity that, you know, has not been fully exploited, I think, in the last 100 years was the religion, this thing that actually can give meaning. It's built to give meaning, but that had, you know, in a way been neglected, and that all these books were kind of addressing that question of, you know, what do we have to do to actually pump some life into this thing?
So rather than find meaning in something like Pittsburgh, to really find it in the source material of Judaism itself.
Yeah, I think so.
All right, Gaal Vakerman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Azra bag collection and its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Azra is the bag to carry for your 9-to-5 and your 5-to-9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Azra collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building, find an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
So here's a request for our listeners. I get lots of feedback from you, some complaints, lots of kind words. Really appreciate it. You can always reach me directly at books@nytimes.com. I will write back. But you can also, if you feel moved to do so, review us on any platform where you download the podcast, whether that's iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play or somewhere else. Please feel free to review us and, of course, email us at any time.
Ben, I did not want to write to you. I wanted to write a lie. I did not want to write honestly about black lies, black thighs, black loves, black laughs, black foods, black addiction, black stretch marks, black dollars, black words, black abuses, black blues, black belly buttons, black wins, black bins, black consent, black parents, or black children. I did not want to write about us. I wanted to write an American memoir. I wanted to write a lie. I wanted to do that old black work of pandering and lying to folk who pay us to pander and lie to them every day. I wanted to write about our family's relationships to simple carbohydrates, deep fried meats, and high fructose corn syrup. I wanted the book to begin with my weighing 319 pounds and end with my weighing 165 pounds. I wanted to pepper the book with acerbic warnings to us fat black folk in the Deep South and saccharine sentimental exhortations from Grandmama. I did not want you to laugh. I wanted to write a lie. I wanted to write about how fundamental present black fathers, responsible black mothers, magical black grandmothers, and perfectly disciplined black children are to our liberation. I wanted to center a something, a someone who wants us dead and dishonest. I wanted white Americans who have proven themselves even more unwilling to confront their lies, to reconsider how their lies limit our access to good love, healthy choices, and second chances. I wanted the book to begin and end with the assumption that if white Americans reckon with their insatiable appetites for black American suffering, and we reckon with our insatiable appetites for unhealthy food, we could all be ushered into a reformed era of American prosperity. I wanted to create a fantastic literary spectacle. I wanted that literary spectacle to ask nothing of you, Grandmama, or me, other than our adherence to a low-carb diet, limited sugar, weightlifting, 12,000 steps a day, gallons of water, and no eating after midnight. I wanted you to promise. I did not want you to remember. I wanted to write a lie. I wanted that lie to be titillating. I wrote that lie. It was titillating. You would have loved it. I discovered nothing. You would have loved it.
That was Kiese Lehmann reading from his new book, Heavy, an American Memoir. Kiese joins us now from Oxford, Mississippi. Kiese, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
So this is a book that has just inspired so much praise from critics, from readers. There's a lot of excitement around it. Let's start with why you decided to write a memoir in the first place. You'd written a novel. You've written a book of essays. Why did you want to write a memoir?
I mean, I started trying to write this memoir at 12 when I didn't even really know what memoir was. And I sort of needed to write the novel that I wrote, and I needed to write the book of essays to get me to a place where I felt like confident enough to even try to write a memoir like this, which is about memoirs directly addressed to my mother about lies we told each other and secrets we were supposed to keep. And what I feel like is like the fracturing of like what I call like American promise. There's a lot of promises in this book that just get broken over and over again. So I just couldn't do it until this point in my life. And I needed to get those other two books sort of behind me to just pack up the skills, I think, needed to pull it off.
When you say like to get ready for it, and you mentioned skills, like was it about the writing itself or was it about feeling sort of emotionally ready to write about yourself in that way?
For me, those things are just tied, right? So when I thought about writing this book for years, I couldn't hear who I was writing to. I was writing to a general reader, and I couldn't understand what would be different in this memoir than what I did in my essays, for example. The novel was a really different kind of writing, but this writing, I think, needed a particular kind of urgency. When I was thinking about writing it for years, I didn't think, oh, if you directly address it to your mom, it'll have a necessary urgency. It'll also have necessary pauses and gaps that she could feel and that the reader could hopefully feel like F-E-E-L through her. So yeah, I just had to, you know, I had to try to write the second part. I wrote a second person essay in my collection of essays. And I wrote about children a lot in my novel. And I think just thinking about children's perspective and sensibilities and thinking about the way they assemble words and thinking about the way parents, at least in my communities, tried to police that assemblage of words for fear that we would be terrorized by white supremacy more. All of that just helped me get ready to write on the sentence level a book like this, which is, you know, on one level, you know, very heavy, on some level dark, but also sort of funny and comical to me, but really it's writing into the creases of things that I was told I definitely shouldn't write or talk about.
You also wrote that you wanted to write an American memoir, that would be a lie. And yet the book is subtitled An American Memoir. And I'm interested in, like, what does that mean to you, the idea? What is an American memoir?
Well, I think that thankfully there's so many different kinds of American memoirs, but I think the kind of American memoir that I was encouraged to write by lots of different people was really an American memoir of progress. Like, this book started out being about weight loss. Like, I was going to lose 150 pounds while talking to my mother and my grandmother about their weight gain and their relationships to food. And I luckily also have been judges of lots and lots of memoir contests over the last 3 years. And so, I mean, I get to see what a lot of people are doing, but I'm also get to see how I think writers believe that their readers want to believe that there's progress or deliverance or resolution on the other end. And so I wanted to talk about, when I talk about the American memoir in this beginning, I'm talking about that urge that we want to see, like, the protagonist win. We want to make a hero out of the protagonist. And I kind of wanted to show the reader early on that there might be resolutions, but then there are going to be breaks. And then there are going to be, you know, there might be discoveries, but then those discoveries are going to seem false. And so I just wanted to prepare the reader for this desire for resolution that never comes, this desire for deliverance that never comes. But I also, in doing that, wanted to broaden what I consider the American memoir's possibility. You know, I wanted to make this book part of the American, not just literary canon, but just part of what American memoirs can be, while criticizing what America asks of our memoirs.
Well, one thing that's very hard, it can be helpful, but also I think really difficult for anyone working on a memoir is to read other memoirs. And it sounds like you read a lot of them. Were there things that you saw and you said, you know what, I am not doing that? And were there any models or anything that inspired you?
I think I read every memoir that came out for the last 2 or 3 years because I was judging LA Times Memoir Award, and I was judging the Penn Award at the LA Times for 2 years. So what I loved about what most people were doing was that there was an obvious appreciation of what writers called home. And I was really interested in like how people went into home. Did they go into it through food, through smell, through sound? And what I wanted to do was go into home through words, and how my mother and people around my community believed that words were just as important as like behavior, like how you spoke, when you spoke. And so I wanted to do that. And also, I just read a ton of memoirs about what we now call Black Lives Matter, because, you know, there's just been a lot of memoirs that have come out. No Ashes in the Fire by Darnell Moore, for example, was one of the mm-hmm. memoirs that I think did a really great job of bringing in like the ultra political, the ultra geographically specific and historical with like something really personal. And so when I started that Darnell did that, I was like, okay, so there's a history of Jackson. I keep on trying to think about how to bring that history of Jackson into the book. And because he did it so well, I was just like, you know what? Let's bring the history of Jackson into the book through bodies, right? Through my mom's body and through my grandmother's body, and leave a lot of that social political history sort of out or subtextual. I learned a lot about what I wanted to do, but I also saw some people do things better than I could do them. And if they could do them a lot better, I'm like, all right, let me just try another way.
Well, one thing you did that was really distinguishes it from a lot of memoirs is you wrote in the second person. Why did you do that?
Again, I wrote this book 3 or 4 times before, and I couldn't figure out who I really wanted to talk to. And then, I actually did figure it out. And I was just scared. I was just really afraid to write to the woman who taught me how to read, taught me how to write, punished me for not reading correctly, punished me for not writing correctly. And that was my mother. And so I wanted the center of this book to be like, you know, a Black woman from central Mississippi, from a rural Black town who loved words, but also, you know, love the idea of parenting more than the actuality of parenting. Like, I wanted that to be the center. And to make that the center, I could have written about my mom, but a lot of memoirs do that. So I just really wanted to write it to my mom, telling her what I saw, telling her what I appreciate, and telling her really that I think we can be better if we use words more effectively to talk to one another from this point forward.
It also, it seems, elevates the relationship in a way over the individual, the relationship that you had with your mother.
Absolutely. I wanted to give the reader the feeling that they were, yeah, listening to my voice, but also peeking into a relationship on every single page, and how a relationship communicatively like changes as time goes on.
Well, tell us about your mother and about that relationship.
Yeah, so my mom, you know, she had me when she was a sophomore at Jackson State University. She graduated early. She went to graduate school. While she was in grad school, I went back and forth between Forest, Mississippi and Wisconsin. And then she was really dedicated to Mississippi. She was just one of these Mississippi kids who really believed that, like, those people who can leave Mississippi probably should not and probably should try to stay and fight. So she tried to stay and fight the way she knew, through political science, through teaching, through organizing, through strategizing in central Mississippi. And she just really believed that reading and writing were the things that were going to save her son from the worst parts of the country, which she believed were the worst parts of our state. And, you know, like a lot of parents, especially a lot of young parents, you know, I saw her make a ton of mistakes. And at different times, she was like my best friend in the world. And at different times, she was my arch enemy. And, you know, even though I've written a book, I still think we vacillate between best friend and arch enemy. I think she's really proud of the book I wrote. I think she really probably wishes that I would not have revealed so much about our relationship or me or her.
Yeah, I mean, that was going to be one of my main questions. Did you show it to her before?
Yeah. Well, because I was trying to do this other project first, which was talking to her about her relationships to food and body, like the book is really based off conversations I had with her. So stories she told me and stories my grandmother told me. And, you know, some of those stories I knew were just, you know, sort of hyperbolic or not true. And they were honest. They were like, we're telling you this version because we don't want you to put the real version in the book. And mm-hmm, then I was mm-hmm. like, okay, so I probably need to try to write y'all a real version of my memory then. My mother was part of the process, you know, so I didn't give her veto power over everything. But most of the things that she said she did not want in the book, I took out of the book.
How hard was it for you to get to the real version, to your real version? Because you're hearing all these other stories. Memory is obviously tricky. And you have two people who are in this story who are obviously personally invested in it.
It was hard. But again, my mother, the thing she gave me in my life that I think is most important is like this gift of revision. Like I had to write and revise before I could do anything. I played lots of sports when I was young. Before I could do them, I had to actually write and revise. I'm just really indebted to her. So it was hard. Like it took like 14 or 15 drafts for me to realize, okay, I'm writing this to my mother. And then I had to rewrite the whole thing. But again, I think it's important that it took revision to get to that point, right? Because she gave me that. And the book really is about revision much more than it is about progress.
How did she feel about you writing about, I mean, I'll just be upfront about it, some of the more abusive and really tough kind of parenting that she did?
That's a tough question because, I mean, I left out a lot of things I think could be seen as most sort of violent or abusive, not just from my mom, but from a lot of different people involved.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, when I left high school and I started to write how I wanted to write publicly for my newspaper in college, my mom didn't like what I was doing with satire. She's not liked like what I do with my writerly practice for a long time, but she likes that I have a writerly practice. So she knew I was going to write a book. That was going to make her squirm a bit. But when she saw exactly what I was doing, she was just like, "Key, I don't think you're going to be able to work after this, you know, because I'm a teacher, right?" And she comes from that school, that generation where, like, you know, your students should see you as, you know, the impenetrable point of a pyramid. And if they see your life in, like, complicated layers, they might not give you intellectual currency. So she worried about my professional life when she read the book.
I mean, that mirrors a lot of her sort of way of raising you, of trying to, you know, protect you and ensure that you were both strong and perceived as strong.
Absolutely.
Did that worry you too? Like writing about these things that I mean, anyone would feel vulnerable about, whether it's about, you know, weight, you write about gambling, a lot of things in here that do make you open and vulnerable.
Worry that much about that part of this book, I just didn't want to hurt people. Do you know what I mean? Like I wanted to use, to go back to craft, I wanted to use like the art to kind of texture every character in that, well, almost every character in that. And I worried most about hurting people. And I also had to keep on revising because I didn't want to write this book out of resentment. So if there were people who I know who harmed me, whether it was my mom or somebody else, I didn't want to put it out there when I was feeling it. So I needed to write through that. And I also didn't want to capitalize on like my hurting other people. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't want to make a spectacle of the harm that I'd done to myself, but also to other people. But I wasn't too worried about professional, you know, like I had tenure when I started the book, you know what I mean? And I teach literary nonfiction, like I teach contemporary Black literature. So I'm always talking to my students about how we artfully excavate who we think we are and who we are. So in some way, this book is modeling some of the work that I want my students to be able to do. I'm not saying they need to do it, but I wasn't worried about the professional stuff. I was just worried about harming people.
The title of the book, I want to talk about that. The obvious thing that one thinks about, given what you described earlier, is about physical weight. But it seems like it's a lot more. And there was one passage which I want to read and would love to hear you talk about. This is also from very close to the beginning of the book. You write, "This summer, it took one final conversation with Grandmama for me to understand that no one in our family, and very few folk in this nation, has any desire to reckon with the weight of where we've been. Which means no one in our family and very few folk in this nation wants to be free." It seems like you're writing that heavy is about all kinds of burdens.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and I wanted to think about how the bodily burdens are tied to a lot of the national burdens, right? Like, at least where I'm from, like, there's this belief that, like, if you're lighter, you are necessarily freer. And in my life, you know, when I was my lightest, you know, I was eating one meal every few days. I was working out obsessively, but I felt euphoric. You know, I felt what the nation tells you you can feel if you're lighter. And so I really just wanted to write about the paradox of lightness, like literal lightness, and also the paradox of like heaviness. And early in the book, my grandmother, you know, she's talking about how important it is to be heavy. And for her, heaviness was a communal thing. You know, like if our arms are locked together, we're heavier than we are if we're just singular. And the book is also about how the nation in some ways tries to blow away people who are light, you know, and so often succeeds in breaking and blowing away folks. So I wanted to just talk about, I wanted to locate a lot of that in the body and the familial, while also critiquing, again, traditional American notions of education, of progress, of success.
Well, let's talk about that latter part, the politics of it. We're having this conversation shortly after the midterm elections. This book is coming out in 2018. We're at a very particular moment in time, but you've been working on this book for a long time, as you said, you know, in your mind since you were 12 years old. How did it change in recent years, given what's been going on in this country?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the next to final drafts of the book, there was a lot more explicit Trump stuff in the book, like Trump's name was in the book. And then I just realized, you know, I'm talking about the country that made Trump king. That's one of the lines I say, not necessarily like Trump, because Trump is, to me, a huge problem because he in some way embodies everything we're supposed to aspire to as cisgendered men in this culture. You know, you want to grow up with two parents, you want to go to the best schools, all of that kind of stuff. And then so I'm looking again at like what America tells us success looks like. On the surface, Trump looks like a success, right? To me, Trump is an abysmal failure as like an American boy who became an American man. I wanted to say all of that without using Trump. You know, I wanted to talk about the way America sometimes encourages the wrong kind of win at the expense of a lot of truth, but also at the expense of a lot of vulnerable people. Trump is a living embodiment of that. But again, even though I think he had help, a lot of Americans in this country who happen to be white wanted that guy to be president.
Right, right. If you make it about that one person, it in a way kind of reduces or excuses.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And my editor agreed, and she was like, we don't even want to put that dude's name in the book. We want to, you know, we want to talk about what the worst parts of this culture that enabled him, that needs to be in the book. And I do feel like that's in the book, you know, and that worst part is embodied by me often, and the worst part is confronted by me. But this notion that you never look backwards, you refuse to look back and take responsibility and care for who you've become and what you've done and who you've left in your wake, that's Trump. And Americans, particularly white Americans, since most of those who voted for him, looked at that kind of man and was like, that's the kind of man we want to be the symbol of our country, who our children look to as president, which says everything about this nation. This is everything about like who we become and how we become and like the consequences sometimes of being successful American men, you know, like, and that's what I wanted to write about. Because if we don't have a president who's modeling a kind of like liberatory reflection, we got to have artists who try to do it. So that's what I thought.
Do you feel like in the end you wrote the memoir you did want to write?
I got close to writing the memoir I really wanted to write, and I didn't completely pull it off, but I got really close. And the mistakes that I made or the failures that I have in that book that I couldn't pull off, I'm going to try to pull off in my next project. So I didn't get all the way there, but I got really close.
Well, we look forward to the next one. I have to say, this is one of those books where there are times a review runs in the New York Times, and I've got people around the newsroom emailing me saying, how's that book? We want to read that book. Do you have a copy of that book? And this was one of those. So thank you so much for joining us.
Congratulations. Thank you so much for having me.
Kiese Leemon's new book is called Heavy, an American Memoir. Joining us now to talk about what's going on in the literary world, we have Alexander Alter. Alexander, hi.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new?
So this week, the final awards in the long literary award season were announced. It was the National Book Awards, and it was a exciting ceremony as always, and it was a little different this year because they had the translation prize, which was newly reintroduced this year. So that was, I think people were quite excited about that. And Nick Offerman was the host, so there was a little bit of celebrity aura around it. He told a lot of off-color jokes that I couldn't put into my copy in my story, but I think the crowd enjoyed it. And so there were some interesting choices this year. It wasn't sort of the usual suspects. Mm-hmm. They were kind of more under the
radar.
Actually,
Isabel Allende also made a kind of off-color remark there.
I think that was like the biggest applause line of the night when Isabel Allende, who received a Lifetime Achievement Award and was actually the first Spanish language author to ever receive it, which I thought was fascinating. She noted during her acceptance speech that she is still having sex at age 76, and everyone cheered, which was nice. So some of the other sort of surprises and exciting moments of the night, the big award, of course, is always fiction, and it went this year to Sigrid Nunez for The Friend, which I think was kind of an under-the-radar quiet novel. I mean, mm-hmm. I think critics really love her and have been following her work, And this novel got tremendous reviews. Dwight Garner reviewed it for us. And it sounds like a very sort of acerbic story about a writer who adopts a Great Dane after her friend commits suicide. And she's a cat person in a tiny apartment, so she has this giant dog. So there's a bit of humor and also, you know, a lot of human emotions about dealing with death and loss.
Who is she? Like, is this, how many books has she written and where's she from?
She's published a number of books. I think people have been following her career closely. But as I sort of detected from her acceptance speech, and you were there too, she seems like we were kind of typical writerly introvert. So she was saying that the reason writing appealed to her was that it gave her a way to basically be alone in her room but still connect with the world. So she wasn't a marquee name and is out and about kind of in the literary world. So I think people will be paying a lot more attention. I bought the book right away and I'm going to start reading it. Some other interesting winners last night. I always love the Poetry Award because that's, you know, a field that I have to confess I don't follow super closely. And so it's often the person who wins often is sort of new to me. And this year, I think the person who won was new to a lot of people is Justin Philip Reed. And he won for his collection Indecency. And he gave a lovely speech that just sort of, he seemed incredibly humbled and excited. And I think he, you know, it seemed like something that he dreamed would happen, but he was still stunned by it.
So he gave lots of credit to his mom.
He did. I always like the mom shout-outs. I think those are a very good sign of character as a mother. The other winners were Jeffrey C. Stewart. He won for his biography of Elaine Locke. Elaine Locke was a philosopher who was very close with a lot of important figures in the Harlem Renaissance, including Zora Neale Hurston. And he said something interesting in his acceptance speech, too, which was that, you know, Elaine Locke was a closeted gay man, and he wouldn't have, you know, he didn't have a family, but he sort of created this family of artists around him. And I thought it was very interesting to sort of connect Elaine Locke's personal life with this movement that he was so influential in shaping. I'd never thought of it that way.
And that was The New Negro, which was published by Oxford University Press, which I think had two finalists.
You know, it's interesting this year. I felt like the nonfiction finalists were more reflective of slightly more obscure subjects from academic presses, whereas in the past couple of years, we've seen a lot of big politics kind of books sort of tapping into the national conversation. And this year, I felt like these were sort of quieter books, but important ones. So that was interesting.
What about kids?
Kids is always a great category. And this year, people were really excited because the prize went to Elizabeth Acevedo for her novel, The Poet X, which won for young people's literature. And it's a novel written in verse about a teenage girl from a Dominican family who's kind of struggling with, you know, rites of passage, adolescence, and sort of figuring out who she is. And I think, you know, this it's an interesting form because it sort of blends a little bit of poetry with some prose. She gave a lovely acceptance speech where she spoke about the joy of having readers approach her and say, you know, I've never seen my life reflected in a book before. I've never read a book about someone like me. And that was very meaningful for her.
Any surprises, like anything else that sort of happened outside of the awards that, you know, you thought was interesting at
you
the
know,
ceremony?
I'm always kind of glued to my laptop, to be honest, and I'm not necessarily picking up the great gossip that I know is swirling around the room, because this is really the one night of the year where the entire literary and publishing world comes together in one big room. And so I'm sure there was amazing gossip that I wasn't able to eavesdrop on as closely as I would have liked. You know, I will say kind of, you know, the award caps the end of the fall big literary awards season. And it was kind of, I wouldn't say a downer this year, but it was kind of quiet. I mean, the Nobel was canceled because of the sexual misconduct scandal at the Swedish Academy. And that was, I think, kind of a big bummer for publishers and writers in the literary world, because that's such a big deal. The Booker was, you know, kind of quiet this year. It was sort of a writer, Anna Burns, that people hadn't been following, and it's great for her career, but it wasn't like a big surprise. She's from Northern Ireland, and it was kind of like your classic Booker sort of win. So I would say, you know, this was sort of a quieter National Book Awards, too. I think in the last couple of years, we've seen people get up and give kind of fiery political speeches. And there's been sort of, I guess, more of a thematic coherence that I didn't really pick up on last night. But why not make it about the individual books, which I think, you know, each one kind of shines in that way. So
one last thing. This was the first year where there was a prize for fiction in translation.
Yes. And I think people were very enthusiastic about that. It's a funny thing because it definitely shifts kind of the purpose of the awards. They're supposed to celebrate the best in American literature, and this is broadening that definition quite a bit. The prize was open this year to books that were published in America and in translation from abroad. So that wouldn't include overseas authors writing in English. And the winner this year was Yoko Tawada for The Emissary, and her translator, Margaret Matsuni, who gave a little bit of the acceptance speech. Yoko Tawada couldn't be there. She did send a lovely note with a friend to read. So,
all right. Well, congratulations to all. Thank you, Alexandra.
Thanks, Pamela.
Joining us now to talk about what we're reading, we have my colleagues Emily Aiken, Tina Jordan, and John Williams. Hi, guys.
Hey, Pamela.
Hi, Pamela.
All right, Emily, let's start with you.
I'm reading a book to my 10-year-old daughter that is just wonderful. It's called The Evolution of Calpurnia Tate by Jacqueline Kelly. It's a middle grade novel that won a Newbery Medal in 2010. And the author is an interesting person. She was born in New Zealand and grew up on Vancouver Island and eventually moved to Texas, where the novel is set. And before she became a writer, apparently she practiced medicine and went to law school. So she's clearly a person of abundant intellectual curiosity, and all of that is channeled through her heroine, this 12-year-old girl named Calpurnia Virginia Tate, known as Callie V, who lives on a 90-acre pecan farm in rural Texas in 1899. Calpurnia is a budding naturalist, and she's just a brilliant, witty observer of the natural world and of her family. She has five brothers. But at the center of the novel is Calpurnia's relationship with her grandfather, this crusty Civil War veteran who has a laboratory in which he does mysterious things on the property. And it turns out he's fermenting pecans to make some kind of liquor, but he's actually also a Darwinian, and he introduces Calpurnia to Darwin's ideas, and the novel just takes off, and they're off on these adventures. They're discovering new species of plants and sending photographs of them to the Smithsonian. It's just a wonderful, witty adventure of a novel.
Sold. All right.
Yeah, seriously.
Tina, what about you?
All right. So I'm in the middle of a book that Parle just reviewed for us. It's called My Sister, the Serial Killer, and I'm going to mangle this first name, so I think I'll spell it. O-Y-I-N-K-A-N. How should we say that?
Oyinkan?
Oyinkan Braithwaite. It's a darkly comic thriller set in Lagos, and the main character is a young woman who's a nurse whose sister is a serial killer.
And I love this title and cover more than anything else coming out in December.
Yeah, so let's describe the cover. It just shows a woman wearing sunglasses, and reflected in the sunglasses is somebody's raised knife, a dagger. So her sister, who's the beautiful one, you know, who doesn't hold a job, who's whatever, she has a problem and keeps killing men. Does this have anything to do with the fact that their father used to beat them senseless with a cane? Maybe. I mean, there are definitely nature versus nurture questions explored here. But the main character, because she's a nurse and she's very good at cleaning, always gets her sister out of these crime scenes. I just want to read you the first few lines. I bet you didn't know that bleach masks the smell of blood. Most people use bleach indiscriminately, assuming it's a catch-all product. Bleach will disinfect, but it's not great for cleaning residue, so I use it only after I first scrubbed the bathroom of all traces of life and death.
Quite arresting.
It is. And, you know, it's not quite like anything I've read before. I think you were saying, John, it was a really big deal when it was published in Nigeria.
Well, I think in Parle's review, or at least maybe she and I were discussing it outside the review, she said that it got a really big advance in Nigeria. So at the time it was published there, it had a lot of buzz. It sounds very TV ready, too, to me.
It does. It's ready to be a, you know, a limited series.
I feel like I'm combining, Emily mentioned the Civil War, and Tina's book is fiction, but it's preoccupied with death. I'm reading something that combines those things. We just passed the 100th anniversary of the armistice that ended World War I, and I actually have a very large shelf of books at home about World War I. I've only read a handful of them, but I kind of collect them for one day, I guess. And I also have a shelf of Jeff Dyer's books at home, so this kind of overlaps the two. It's Dyer's book called The Missing of the Sum, which I think was published something. I thought it was more recent than this. I think it was 1994 is the copyright date on it. And it's, you know, it's a slim book. And in typical Jeff Dyer fashion, it's very ruminative and not highly focused. He just talks a lot about remembrance and the way that people thought about the war, and especially how the British memorialized their dead. And he visits sites of memorials and graveyards and battle sites and talks a lot about the World War I poets. And so I'm making my way through it. It's a lovely little book, and I think it probably won't send me running to the thicker books I have about the war quite yet, but I would recommend it. What about you, Pamela?
Well, I've been reading this anthology that was published in 1973, but has been subsequently reissued, called The Science Fiction Hall of Fame, Volume 2A, The Greatest Science Fiction Novellas of All Time, chosen by the members of the Science Fiction Writers of America, SF Hall of Fame, which is a kind of a mouthful. I have a number of these at home because science fiction is a category that I just have not read enough of. And the few times that I've read it, I've loved it. Only sometime in the last 10 years read 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And so I've been meaning to turn back to some of the classics and settled on this because my husband, who's better read in science fiction, he said this is the one to start with because some of the greatest science fiction is actually not in the form of novels, but in the form of novellas and short stories. So these are called novellas, but they're more like short stories. And the first two that I've read have been particularly good. The first one in the collection is called Call Me Joe by Poole Anderson. Any listeners who are science fiction people probably know all about this story, but I had never heard of it, which is about a paraplegic man who psychically sort of teleports down to a genetically engineered creature on Jupiter from a satellite that is going around Jupiter and sort of has a life inside this creature. And eventually, as the story unfolds, becomes more and more keen to be in the body of this sort of Jovian monster than in his own physically limited body back in the satellite. And I'm reading it and I'm thinking, this is Avatar. This is Avatar. Like, how could this not be Avatar? So when I finished, I naturally went to Google. And in fact, the minute you put in Call Me Joe into Google, you know, Avatar pops up. And when the movie came out, there was a lot of discussion that he should have credited Poole Anderson with this idea. So I sort of gave myself a little pat on the back for, like, someone who knows nothing about science fiction, actually coming to this conclusion. But then I was sort of swiftly brought back to earth with the next story that I read, which is called Who Goes There by John Campbell. It's a great story in which there are scientists in Antarctica who come across what is clearly a crash site of some, you know, spaceship from another world. And among what they find there is a big chunk of ice with a creature within the ice, frozen solid, that they, of course, bring back to their station and let it defrost, even though they can see through the ice that it has three hate-filled evil eyes and worm-like green hair that is moving even as it is still frozen. And there is the natural debate among the scientists. The biologist wants to thaw the creature out slowly. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to analyze this creature from another planet. Others are not so sure that this is a good idea.
The sane ones.
So when I was done, I was like, wow, I can't believe this hasn't been made into a movie. And of course, duh, it has three times, the most famous of which is probably The Thing by John Carpenter's 1986 or 82 film, which I then started to watch and was very disappointed. You know, now I know why fans of science fiction are often let down by the movie incarnations of the work, because it didn't follow the narrative at all. And, you know, my kids afterwards were saying, well, but how did they handle the Norwegians in the story? I'm like, there were no Norwegians in the story. And it just was completely different from the story itself. So I urge people to go back and read it. I don't know about watching The Thing, because I stalked out in a huff because it diverged too far from the original text. So that's what I'm reading.
Well, hopefully you'll have a few more to tell us about, because it's a big collection, right?
It is. I've got 9 more novellas to
I know you're just beginning your excursion into classic science fiction, but I'm curious, have you met any female characters?
Well, no, not yet. And interestingly, this collection is the kind of collection that would probably never come together today. It was done in 1973, by this group of science fiction writers before the Nebula Awards and the Hugo Awards sort of took off. So this was their way of saying, well, hey, now we have this annual award, but there was so much great stuff out there before that went unrecognized. So let's gather it all together and vote on the best. But it's all men also.
This is what I remember from when I was much younger and getting interested in science fiction. And I went back to the classic books by Robert Heinlein and Isaac Asimov. I couldn't find any female characters.
Well, that's why the Madeleine L'Engle's A Wrinkle in Time was so pivotal for me as a girl. And it's interesting, too. And I wrote an essay for the Book Review, maybe 10 years ago about this, that I didn't continue in science fiction after reading what was then a trilogy because that was sort of all there was for me or that was written for me or that felt accessible to me. And I don't think that the industry overall even contemplated that girls might be interested in this. So the books were like not marketed in a way that would be friendly to, you know, a 12-year-old girl.
Although now I just have to say there's so much great science fiction written by women with kick-ass women characters.
All right. Well, then you can all read these in future and discuss them. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. I write back. The Book Review podcast is produced by Peter Rosato from Headstepper Media, with the great help of my colleague John Williams. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.